There were perhaps a dozen folks, including Sheb the piano player and Barky the bouncer, sleeping it off. No one was close enough to listen to the low-voiced conversation of the two men by the door, even if one of the snoring drunkards was, for some reason, only shamming sleep. Jonas put a red queen on a black knight, then looked up at Reimer.
"Say you say?"
"Those two said it for me, actually. Side de Pape will never be embarrassed by a surplus of brains, but Reynolds is fairly smart for a gunny, isn't he?
Clay's trig when the moon's right and he's had a shave,"
Jonas agreed. "Are you saying you came all the way from Seafront to tell me those three babbies need a closer looking at?"
Reimer shrugged.
"Perhaps they do, and I'm the man to do it, if so, right enough, but what's there to find?"
"That's to be seen," Reimer said, and tapped one of Jonas's cards. "There's a chancellor."
"Aye? Near as ugly as the one I'm sitting with."
Jonas put the chancellor, it was Paul, above his run of cards. The next draw uncovered Luke, whom he put next to Paul. That left Peter and Matthew still lurking in the bush. Jonas looked at Reimer shrewdly.
"You hide it better than my pals, but you're as nervous as they are underneath. You want to know what's out at that bunkhouse? I'll tell you. Extra boots, pictures of their mommies, socks that stink to high heaven, stiff sheets from boys who've been taught it's low class to chase after the sheep, and guns hidden somewhere under the floorboards, like enough."
"You really think they have guns?"
"Aye, Roy got the straight of that, all right. They're from Gilead. They're likely from the line of Eld, or from folk who like to think they're from it, and they're likely prentices to the trade who've been sent on with guns they haven't earned yet. I wonder a bit about the tall one with the I-don't-give-a-shit look in his eyes. He might already be a gunslinger, I suppose. But is it likely? I don't think so. Even if he is, I could take him in a fair go. I know it, and he does, too."
"Then why have they been sent here?"
"Not because those from the inner barony suspect your treason, sigh Reimer. Be easy on that score."
Reimer's head poked out of his serape as he sat up straight, and his face stiffened. "How dare you call me a traitor? How dare you?"
Eldred Jonas favored Hambry's minister of inventory with an unpleasant smile. It made the white-haired man look like a wolverine.
"I've called things by their right names my whole life, and I won't stop now. All that needs matter to you is that I've never double-crossed an employer."
"If I didn't believe in the cause, of to hell with what you believe.
It's late and I want to go to bed. The folk in New Canaan and Gilead haven't the foggiest idea of what does or doesn't go on out here on the Crescent. There aren't many of them who've ever been here, I'd wager. Them are too busy trying to keep everything from falling down around their ears to do much traveling these days. No, what they know is all from the picture books they was read out of when there's babbies themselves. Happy cowboys galloping after stock, happy fishermen pulling whoppers into their boats, folks clogging at barn raisings and drinking big pots of graff and Greenheart Pavilion. For the sake of the man Jesus, Reimer, don't go dense on me. I deal with that day in and day out."
"They see Magus as a place of quiet and safety."
"Aye, bucolic splendor, just so, no doubt about it. They know that their whole way of life, all that nobility and chivalry and ancestor worship, is on fire. The final battle may take place as much as 200 wheels northwest of their borders, but when Farson uses his fire carriages and robots to wipe out their army, trouble will come south fast. There are those from the inner baronies who smelled this coming for 20 years or more. They didn't send these brats here to discover your secrets, Reimer. Folks such as these don't send their babbies into danger on purpose. They sent them here to get them out of the way. That's all. That doesn't make them blind or stupid, but for the sake of the gods, let's be sane. They're kiddies."
"What else might you find should you go out there?"
"Some way of sending messages, mayhap. Heliographs, most likely. And out beyond Eyebolt, a shepherd, or maybe a freeholder susceptible to a bribe, someone they've trained to catch the message and either flash it on or carry it afoot. But before long, it'll be too late for messages to do any good, won't it?"
"Perhaps, but it's not too late yet, and you're right, kiddies or not, they worry me."
"You've no cause, I tell you. Soon enough, I'll be wealthy, and you'll be downright rich. Mayor yourself, if you want. Who'd stand to stop you? Thorin, he's a joke. Carl, she'd help you string him up, I want. Or perhaps you'd like to be a baron, if such offices be revived. He saw a momentary gleam in Rymer's eyes and laughed. Matthew came out of the deck, and Jonas put him up with the other chancellors.
"Yeah, I see that's what you've got your heart set on. Gems is nice, and for gold that goes twice. But there's nothing like having folk bow and scrape before you, is there?"
Rymer said, "They should have been on the cowboy side by now." Jonas's hands stopped above the layout of cards. It was a thought that had crossed his own mind more than once, especially over the last 2 weeks or so. "How long do you think it takes to count our nets and boats and chart out the fish hauls?" Rymer said. "They should be over on the drop, counting cows and horses, looking through barns, studying the foal charts. They should have been there 2 weeks ago, in fact, unless they already know what they'd find." Jonas understood what Rymer was implying, but couldn't believe it. Wouldn't believe it. Not such a depth of slyness from boys who only had to shave once a week.
"No," he said, "that's your own guilty heart talking to you. They're just so determined to do it right that they're creeping along like old folks with bad eyes. They'll be over on the drop soon enough and counting their little hearts out."
"And if they're not?" "A good question. Get rid of them somehow," Jonas supposed. "An ambush, perhaps. 3 shots from cover, no more babbies. There'd be ill feeling afterwards, the boys were well liked in town. But Rymer could handle that until fair day, and after the reap it wouldn't matter. Still..."
"I'll have a look around out at the barquet," Jonas said at last. "By myself. I won't have Clay and Roy tramping along behind me."
"That sounds fine.
Perhaps you'd like to come and lend a hand."
Kimber Rymer smiled his icy smile. "I think not." Jonas nodded and began to deal again. Going out to the barquet would be a bit risky, but he didn't expect any real problem, especially if he went alone. They were only boys, after all, and gone for much of each day.
"When may I expect a report?" sighed Jonas. "When I'm ready to make it. Don't crowd me."
Rymer lifted his thin hands and held them, palms out to Jonas.
"Cry your pardon, Si," he said.
Jonas nodded, slightly mollified. He flipped up another card. It was Peter, Chancellor of Keys. He put the card in the top row and then stared at it, combing his fingers through his long white hair as he did. He looked from the card to Rymer, who looked back, eyebrows raised.
"You smile," Rymer said.
"Yeah," Jonas said, and began to deal again. "I'm happy. All the chancellors are out. I think I'm going to win this game." 5. For Rhea, the time of the Huntress had been a time of frustration and unsatisfied craving. Her plans had gone awry, and thanks to her cat's hideously mistimed leap, she didn't know how or why. The young cull who'd taken Susan Delgado's cherry had likely stopped her from chopping her scurf. But how? And who was he really? She wondered that more and more, but her curiosity was secondary to her fury. Rhea of the Coos wasn't used to being balked. She looked across the room to where Musty crouched and watched her carefully. Ordinarily, he would have relaxed in the fireplace. He seemed to like the cool drafts that swirled down the chimney, but since she had singed his fur, Musty preferred the woodpile. Given Rhea's mood, that was probably wise.
"You're lucky I let you live, you warlock," the old woman grumbled.
She turned back to the ball and began to make passes above it, but the glass only continued to swirl with bright pink light. Not a single image appeared. Rhea got up at last, went to the door, threw it open, and looked out on the night sky. Now the moon had waxed a little past the half, and the Huntress was coming clear on its bright face.
Rhea directed the stream of foul language she didn't quite dare to direct at the glass, who knew what entity might lurk inside it, waiting to take offense at such talk, up at the woman in the moon. Twice she slammed her bony old fist into the door lintel as she cursed, dredging up every dirty word she could think of, even the potty-mouth words children throw at each other in the dust of the play yard. Never had she been so angry. She had given the girl a command, and the girl, for whatever reasons, had disobeyed. For standing against Rhea of the Coos, the bitch deserved to die.
"But not right away," the old woman whispered. "First she should be rolled in the dirt, then pissed on till the dirt's mud and her fine blonde hair's full of it. Humiliated, hurt, spat on."
She slammed her fist against the door's side again, and this time blood flew from her knuckles. It wasn't just the girl's failure to obey the hypnotic command. There was another matter, related but much more serious. Rhea herself was now too upset to use the glass, except for brief and unpredictable periods of time. The hand passes she made over it and the incantation she muttered to it were, she knew, useless. The words and gestures were just the way she focused her will. That was what the glass responded to, will and concentrated thought. Now, thanks to the trollop of a girl and her boy lover, Rhea was too angry to summon the smooth concentration needed to part the pink fog which swirled inside the ball. She was, in fact, too angry to see.
"How can I make it like it was?"
Rhea asked the half-glimpsed woman in the moon.
"Tell me! Tell me!"
But the huntress told her nothing, and at last Rhea went back inside, sucking at her bleeding knuckles. Musty saw her coming and squeezed into the cobwebby space between the woodpile and the chimney. Chapter 2 The Girl at the Window. 1. Now the huntress filled her belly, as the old-timer said. Even at noon she could be glimpsed in the sky, a pallid vampire woman caught in bright autumn sunlight. In front of businesses such as the Traveler's Rest, and on the porches of such large ranch houses as Lengel's Rocking Bee and Renfrew's Lazy Susan, stuffy guys with heads full of straw above their old overalls began to appear. Each wore his sombrero, each held a basket of produce cradled in his arms, each looked out at the emptying world with stitched white cross eyes. Wagons filled with squashes clogged the roads. Bright orange drifts of pumpkins and bright magenta drifts of sharproot lay against the sides of barns. In the fields, the potato carts rolled, and pickers followed behind. In front of the Hambry Mercantile, reap charms appeared like magic, hanging from the carved guardians like wind chimes. All over Magus, girls sewed their reaping night costumes, and sometimes wept over them if the work went badly, as they dreamed of the boys they would dance with in the Greenheart Pavilion. Their little brothers began to have trouble sleeping as they thought of the rides and the games and the prizes they might win at the carnival. Even their elders sometimes lay awake, in spite of their sore hands and aching backs, thinking about the pleasures of the reap. Summer had slipped away with a final flirt of her green gown. Harvest time had arrived. Two. Rhea cared not a fig for reaping dances or carnival games, but she could no more sleep than those who did. Most nights she lay on her stinking pallet until dawn, her skull thudding with rage. On a night not long after Jonas's conversation with Chancellor Reimer, she determined to drink herself into oblivion. Her mood was not improved when she found that her graph barrel was almost empty. She blistered the air with her curses. She was drawing in breath for a fresh string of them when an idea struck her. A wonderful idea. A brilliant idea. She had wanted Susan Delgado to cut off her hair. That hadn't worked, and she didn't know why. But she did know something about the girl, didn't she?
Something interesting, aye, so it was. Very interesting indeed.
Rhea had no desire to go to Thorin with what she knew. She had a fond and foolish, likely, hope that the mayor had forgotten about his wonderful glass ball, but the girls aren't now. Suppose Cordelia Delgado were to discover that not only was her niece's virginity lost, the girl was well on her way to becoming a practiced trollop. Rhea didn't think Cordelia would go to the mayor either. The woman was a prig, but not a fool. Yet it would set the cat among the pigeons just the same, wouldn't it?
Wow.
Thinking of cats, there was Musty, standing on the stoop in the moonlight, looking at her with a mixture of hope and mistrust. Rhea, grinning hideously, opened her arms.
Come to me, my precious. Come, my sweet one.
Musty, understanding all was forgiven, rushed into his mistress's arms and began to purr loudly as Rhea licked along his sides with her old and yellowing tongue. That night the coos slept soundly for the first time in a week, and when she took the glass ball into her arms the following morning, its mists cleared for her at once. She spent the day enthralled to it, spying on people she detested, drinking little and eating nothing. Around sunset she came out of her trance enough to realize she had as yet done nothing about the saucy little jade. But that was all right. She saw how it could be done, and she could watch all the results in the glass, all the protests, all the shouting and recriminations. She would see Susan's tears. That would be the best, to see her tears.
A little harvest of my own, she said to Ermot,
who now came slithering up her leg toward the place where she liked him best.
There weren't many men who could do you like Ermot could do you. No, indeed.
Sitting there with a lapful of snake, Rhea began to laugh. 3. Remember your promise, Alan said nervously as they heard the approaching beat of Rusher's hoofs. Keep your temper. I will, Cuthbert said. But he had his doubts. As Roland rode around the long wing of the bunkhouse and into the yard, his shadow trailing out in the sunset light, Cuthbert clenched his hands nervously. He willed them to open, and they did. Then, as he watched Roland dismount, they rolled themselves closed again, the nails digging into his palms. Another go-round, Cuthbert thought. Gods, but I'm sick of them, sick to death. Last night's had been about the pigeons, again. Cuthbert wanted to use one to send a message back west about the oil tankers. Roland still did not. So they had argued. Except, here was another thing which infuriated him, that rubbed against his nerves like the sound of the thinny. Roland did not argue. These days Roland did not deign to argue. His eyes always kept that distant look, as if only his body was here. The rest of him, mind, soul, spirit, ka, was with Susan Delgado. No, he had said simply, it's too late for such.
You can't know that, Cuthbert had argued. And even if it's too late for help to come from Gilead, it's not too late for advice to come from Gilead. Are you so blind you can't see that?
What advice can they send us? Roland hadn't seemed to hear the rawness in Cuthbert's voice. His own voice was calm, reasonable, and utterly disconnected, Cuthbert thought, from the urgency of the situation.
"If we knew that," he had replied, "we wouldn't have to ask Roland, would we?"
"We can only wait and stop them when they make their move. It's comfort you're looking for, Cuthbert, not advice."
"You mean wait while you fuck her in as many ways and in as many places as you can imagine," Cuthbert thought. "Inside, outside, right side up and upside down." "You're not thinking clearly about this," Cuthbert had said coldly.
He'd heard Alain's gasp. Neither of them had ever said such a thing to Roland in their lives, and once it was out he'd waited uneasily for whatever explosion might follow. None did. "Yes," Roland replied. "I am." And he had gone into the bunkhouse without another word. Now, watching Roland uncinch Rusher's girths and pull the saddle from his back, Cuthbert thought, "You're not, you know.
But you better think clearly about this. By all the gods, you'd better.
"I'll," he said as Roland carried the saddle over to the porch and set it on the step.
"Busy afternoon?"
He felt a Len kick his ankle and ignored it.
"I've been with Susan," Roland said.
No defense, no demur, no excuse.
And for a moment Cuthbert had a vision of shocking clarity. He saw the two of them in a hut somewhere, the late afternoon sun shining through holes in the roof and dappling their bodies. She was on top, riding him. Cuthbert saw her knees on the old spongy boards and the tension in her long thighs. He saw how tanned her arms were, how white her belly. He saw how Roland's hands cupped the globes of her breasts, squeezing them as she rocked back and forth above him. And he saw how the sun lit her hair, turning it into a fine spun net.
"Why do you always have to be first?" he cried at Roland in his mind. "Why does it always have to be you? God's damn you, Roland! God's damn you!"
"We were on the docks," Cuthbert said, his tone a thin imitation of his usual brightness, "counting boots and marine tools in what are called clam drags. What an amusing time of it we've had, eh, Al?"
"Did you need me to help you do that?" Roland asked. He went back to Russia and took off the saddle blanket.
"Is that why you sound angry?"
"If I sound angry, it's because most of the fishermen are laughing at us behind our backs. We keep coming back and coming back. Roland, they think we're fools."
Roland nodded. "All to the good," he said.
"Perhaps," Alain said quietly. "But Reimer doesn't think we're fools. It's in the way he looks at us when we pass, nor does Jonas. And if they don't think we're fools, Roland, what do they think?"
Roland stood on the second step, the saddle blanket hanging forgotten over his arm.
For once they actually seem to have his attention, Cuthbert thought. Glory be, and will wonders never cease?
"They think we're avoiding the drop because we already know what's there," Roland said. "And if they don't think it, they soon will."
"Cuthbert has a plan."
Roland's gaze, mild, interested, already starting to be not there again, shifted to Cuthbert. Cuthbert the Joker, Cuthbert the Prentice, who had in no way earned the gun he'd carried east to the Outer Crescent, Cuthbert the Virgin, an eternal second. Gods, I don't want to hate him. I don't, but now it's so easy.
"We two should go and see Sheriff Avery tomorrow," Cuthbert said. "We will present it as a courtesy visit. We've already established ourselves as three courteous, if slightly stupid, young fellows, have we not?"
"To a fault," Roland agreed, smiling.
"We'll say that we've finally finished with the seacoast side of Hambry, and we hope to be every bit as meticulous on the farm and cowboy side. But we certainly don't want to cause trouble or be in anyone's way. It is, after all, the busiest time of year, for ranchers as well as farmers, and even citified fools such as ourselves will be aware of that. So we'll give the good sheriff a list."
Roland's eyes lit up. He tossed the blanket over the porch rail, grabbed Cuthbert around the shoulders, and gave him a rough hug. Cuthbert could smell a lilac scent around Roland's collar and felt an insane but powerful urge to clamp his hands around Roland's throat and try to strangle him. Instead, he gave him a perfunctory clap on the back in return. Roland drew away, grinning widely. "A list of the ranches we'll be visiting," he said. "Aye, and with forewarning they can move any stock they'd like us not to see on to the next ranch, or the last one. The same for tack, feed, equipment. It's masterful, Cuthbert. You're a genius."
"Far from that," Cuthbert said. "I've just spared a little time to think about a problem that concerns us all, that concerns the entire affiliation, mayhap. We need to think, wouldn't you say?"
Alain winced, but Roland didn't seem to notice. He was still grinning. Even at 14, such an expression on his face was troubling. The truth was that when Roland grinned, he looked slightly mad.
"Do you know, they may even move in a fair number of muties for us to look at, just so we'll continue to believe the lies they've already told us about the impurity of their stock lines."
He paused, seeming to think, and then said, "Why don't you and Alain go and see the sheriff, Bert? That would do very well, I think."
At this point, Cuthbert nearly threw himself at Roland, wanting to scream, "Yes, why not? Then you could spend tomorrow morning pronging her as well as tomorrow afternoon. You idiot! You thoughtless, love-struck idiot!"
It was Al who saved him. Saved them all, perhaps.
"Don't be a fool," he said sharply. and Roland wheeled toward him, looking surprised. He wasn't used to sharpness from that quarter.
"You're our leader, Roland, seen that way by Thorin, by Avery, by the townsfolk, seen that way by us as well."
"No one appointed me to—"
"No one needed to," Cuthbert shouted. "You won your guns. These folk would hardly believe it. I hardly believe it myself just lately. But you are a gunslinger. You have to go, plain as the nose on your face. It doesn't matter which of us accompanies you, but you have to go."
He could say more, much more, but if he did, where would it end? With their fellowship broken beyond repair, likely. So he clamped his mouth shut. No need for Alain to kick him this time. And once again waited for the explosion. Once again none came.
"All right,"
Roland said in his new way, that mild, it-doesn't-much-matter way that made Cuthbert feel like biting him to wake him up. "Tomorrow morning, you and I, Bert. Will 8 suit you?"
"Down to the ground," Cuthbert said.
Now that the discussion was over and the decision made, Bert's heart was beating wildly, and the muscles in his upper thighs felt like rubber. It was the way he'd felt after their confrontation with the big coffin hunters. "We'll be at our prettiest," Roland said. "Nice boys from the Inners with good intentions, but not many brains."
"Fine."
And he went inside, no longer grinning, which was a relief, but smiling gently. Cuthbert and Alain looked at each other and let out their breath in a mutual rush. Cuthbert cocked his head toward the yard and went down the steps. Alain followed, and the two boys stood in the center of the dirt rectangle with the bunkhouse at their backs. To the east, the rising full moon was hidden behind a scrim of clouds.
"She's tranced him," Cuthbert said. "Whether she means to or not, she'll kill us all in the end. Wait and see if she don't."
"You shouldn't say such, even in jest."
"All right, she'll crown us with the jewels of Eld, and we'll live forever."
"You have to stop being angry at him, Bert. You have to." Cuthbert looked at him bleakly.
"I can't."
4. The great storms of autumn were still a month or more distant, but the following morning dawned drizzly and gray. Roland and Cuthbert wrapped themselves in serapes and headed for town, leaving Alain to the few home-place chores. Tucked in Roland's belt was the schedule of farms and ranches, beginning with the 3 small spreads owned by the barony the 3 of them had worked out the previous evening. The pace this schedule suggested was almost ludicrously slow. It would keep them on the drop and in the orchards almost until year's end fair, but it conformed to the pace they had already set on the docks. Now the two of them rode silently toward town, both lost in their own thoughts. Their way took them past the Delgado house. Roland looked up and saw Susan sitting in her window, a bright vision in the gray light of that fall morning. His heart leaped up, and although he didn't know it then, it was how he would remember her most clearly forever after. Lovely Susan, the girl at the window. So do we pass the ghosts that haunt us later in our lives. They sit undramatically by the roadside like poor beggars, and we see them only from the corners of our eyes, if we see them at all. The idea that they have been waiting there for us rarely, if ever, crosses our minds, yet they do wait. And when we have passed, they gather up their bundles of memory and fall in behind, treading in our footsteps and catching up, little by little. Roland raised a hand to her. It went toward his mouth at first, wanting to send her a kiss, but that would be madness. He lifted the hand before it could touch his lips and ticked a finger off his forehead instead, offering a saucy little salute. Susan smiled and returned it in kind. None saw Cordelia, who had gone out in the drizzle to check on the last of her squash and sharproot. That lady stood where she was, a sombrero yanked down on her head almost to the eyeline, half hidden by the stuffy guy guarding the pumpkin patch. She watched Roland and Cuthbert pass. Cuthbert she barely saw, her interest was in the other one. From the boy on horseback she looked up to Susan, sitting there in her window, humming as blithely as a bird in a gilded cage.
A sharp splinter of suspicion whispered its way into Cordelia's heart. Susan's change of temperament, from alternating bouts of sorrow and fearful anger to a kind of dazed but mainly cheerful acceptance, had been so sudden. Mayhap it wasn't acceptance at all. "You're mad," she whispered to herself, but her hand remained tight on the haft of the machete she held. She dropped to her knees in the muddy garden and abruptly began chopping sharp-root vines, tossing the roots themselves toward the side of the house with quick, accurate throws.
"There's nothing between 'em. I'd know. Children of such an age have no more discretion than the drunks in the rest."
But the way they had smiled, the way they had smiled at each other.
"Perfectly normal,"
she whispered, chopping and throwing. She cut a sharp root nearly in half, ruining it, not noticing. The whispering was a habit she'd picked up only recently, as reap day neared and the stresses of coping with her brother's troublesome daughter mounted.
"Folks smile at each other, that's all."
The same for the salute and Susan's returning wave. Below, the handsome cavalier acknowledging the pretty maid, above, the maid herself, pleased to be acknowledged by such as he. It was youth calling to youth, that was all. And yet,
the look in his eyes, and the look in hers.
Nonsense, of course.
But you saw something else.
Yes, perhaps. For a moment it had seemed to her that the young man was going to blow Susan a kiss, then had remembered himself at the last moment and turned it into a salute instead.
"Even if ye did see such a thing, it means nothing. Young cavaliers are saucy, especially when out from beneath the gaze of their fathers. And these three already have a history, as you well know."
All true enough, but none of it removed that chilly splinter from her heart. 5. Jonas answered Roland's knock and let the two boys into the sheriff's office. He was wearing a deputy star on his shirt and looked at them with expressionless eyes.
"Boys," he said, "come in out of the wet."
He stepped back to allow them entrance. His limp was more pronounced than Roland had ever seen it. The wet weather was playing it up, he supposed. Roland and Cuthbert stepped in. There was a gas heater in the corner, filled from the candle at Sitgo, no doubt, and the big room, which had been cool on the day when they had first come here, was stuporously hot. The three cells held 5 woeful-looking drunks, 2 pairs of men, and a woman in the center cell by herself, sitting on the bunk with her legs spread wide, displaying a broad expanse of red drawers. Roland feared that if she got her finger any farther up her nose, she might never retrieve it. Clay Reynolds was leaning against the notice board, picking his teeth with a broom straw. Sitting at the roll-top desk was Deputy Dave, stroking his chin and frowning through his monocle at the board which had been set up there. Roland wasn't at all surprised to see that he and Bert had interrupted a game of castles.
"Well, look here, Eldred," Reynolds said. "It's 2 of the in-world boys. Do your mommies know you're out, fellas?"
"They do," Cuthbert said brightly. "And you're looking very well, Si Reynolds. The wet weather soothed your pox, has it?" Without looking at Bert or losing his pleasant little smile, Roland shot an elbow into his friend's shoulder. "Pardon my friend, Si. His humor regularly transgresses the bounds of good taste. He doesn't seem able to help it. There's no need for us to scratch at one another. We've agreed to let bygones be bygones, haven't we?"
"Aye, certainly. All a misunderstanding," Jonas said.
He limped back across to the desk and the game board. As he sat down, on his side of it, his smile turned to a sour little grimace.
"I'm worse than an old dog," he said. "Someone ought to put me down, so they should. Earth's cold but painless, eh, boys?"
He looked back at the board and moved a man around to the side of his hillock. He had begun to castle and was thus vulnerable. Although not very, in this case, Roland thought, Deputy Dave didn't look like much in the way of competition. "I see you're working for the Barony Salt now," Roland said, nodding at the star on Jonas's shirt.
"Salt's what it amounts to,"
Jonas said, companionably enough. A fella went leg broke. I'm helping out, that's all.
And Cy Reynolds? Cy DePape, are they helping out as well?
Yeah, I reckon, Jonas said. How goes your work among the fisher folk? Slow, I hear.
Done, at last. The work wasn't so slow as we were. But coming here in disgrace was enough for us. We have no intention of leaving that way. Slow and steady wins the race, they say.
So they do, Jonas agreed, whoever they are.
From somewhere deeper in the building there came the whoosh of a water stool flushing. All the comforts of home in the Hambry Sheriff's, Roland thought. The flush was soon followed by heavy footsteps descending a staircase, and a few moments later Herc Avery appeared. With one hand he was buckling his belt, with the other he mopped his broad and sweaty forehead. Roland admired the man's dexterity.
"Phew!" the sheriff exclaimed. "Them beans I ate last night took the shortcut, I tell you."
He looked from Roland to Cuthbert and then back to Roland.
"Why, boys, too wet for net counting, is it?"
"Cy Dearborn was just saying that their net counting days are at an end," Jonas said. He combed back his long hair with the tips of his fingers.
Beyond him, Clay Reynolds had resumed his slouch against the notice board, looking at Roland and Cuthbert with open dislike.
"Aye? Well, that's fine, that's fine. What's next, youngsters? And is there any way we here can help ye? For that's what we like to do best. Lend a hand where hand's needed, so it is."
"Actually, you could help us," Roland said. He reached into his belt and pulled out the list. "We have to move on to the drop, but we don't want to inconvenience anyone." Grinning hugely, Deputy Dave slid his squire all the way around his own hillock. Jonas castled at once, ripping open Dave's entire left flank. The grin faded from Dave's face, leaving a puzzled emptiness.
"How'd you manage that?"
"Easy,"
Jonas smiled, then pushed back from the desk to include the others in his regard.
"You want to remember, Dave, that I play to win. I can't help it. It's just my nature."
He turned his full attention to Roland. His smile broadened.
"Like the scorpion said to the maiden as she lay dying, you knowed I was poison when you picked me up."
6. When Susan came in from feeding the livestock, she went directly to the cold pantry for the juice, which was her habit. She didn't see her aunt standing in the chimney corner and watching her, and when Cordelia spoke, Susan was startled badly. It wasn't just the unexpectedness of the voice. It was the coldness of it.
"Do you know him?"
The juice jug slipped in her fingers, and Susan put a steadying hand beneath it. Orange juice was too precious to waste, especially this late in the year. She turned and saw her aunt by the woodbox. Cordelia had hung her sombrero on a hook in the entryway, but she still wore her serape and muddy boots. Her cuchillo lay on top of the stacked wood, with green strands of sharp-root vine still trailing from its edge. Her tone was cold, but her eyes were hot with suspicion. A sudden clarity filled Susan's mind and all of her senses. "If you say no, you're damned," she thought. "If you even ask who, you may be damned. You must say..."
"I know them both,"
she replied in offhand fashion.
"I met them at the party. So did you. You frightened me, Aunt."
"Why did he salute ye so?"
"How can I know? Perhaps he just felt like it."
Her aunt bolted forward, slipped in her muddy boots, regained her balance, and seized Susan by the arms. Now her eyes were blazing.
"Bean't insolent with me, girl. Bean't haughty with me, Miss Oh-So-Young and Pretty, or I'll—"
Susan pulled backward so hard that Cordelia staggered and might have fallen again if the table had not been handy to grab. Behind her, muddy foot tracks stood out on the clean kitchen floor like accusations.
"Call me that again, and I'll slap thee," Susan cried. "So I will."
Cordelia's lips drew back from her teeth in a dry, ferocious smile.
"Ye'd slap your father's only living blood kin? Would ye be so bad?"
"Why not? Do ye not slap me, Aunt?"
Some of the heat went out of her aunt's eyes, and the smile left her mouth.
Susan, hardly ever. Not half a dozen times since you were a toddler who would grab anything her hands could reach, even a pot of boiling water on the...
It's with thy mouth thee mostly it's nowadays, Susan said. I've put up with it,
more fool me, but am done with it now. I'll have no more. If I'm old enough to be sent to a man's bed for money, I'm old enough for ye to keep a civil tongue when you speak to me.
Cordelia opened her mouth to defend herself. The girl's anger had startled her, and so had her accusations. And then she realized how cleverly she was being led away from the subject of the boys. Of the boy.
Ye only know him from the party, Susan. It's Dearborn, I mean.
As I think ye well know.
I've seen him about town, Susan said.
She met her aunt's eyes steadily, although it cost her an effort. Lies would follow half-truths as dark followed dusk.
I've seen all three of them about town. Are you satisfied?
No, Susan saw with mounting dismay, she was not.
Do ye swear to me, Susan, on your father's name, that ye have not been meeting this boy, Dearborn?
All the rides in the late afternoon, Susan thought. All the excuses, all the care that no one should see us, and it all comes down to a careless wave on a rainy morning.
That easily all's put at risk. Did we think it could be otherwise? Were we that foolish?
Yes. And no. The truth was they had been mad, and still were. Susan kept remembering the look of her father's eyes on the few occasions when he had caught her in a fib. That look of half-curious disappointment, the sense that her fibs, innocuous as they might be, had hurt him like the scratch of a thorn.
"I will swear to nothing," she said. "You've no right to ask it of me."
"Swear!" Cordelia cried shrilly. She groped out for the table again and grasped it as if for balance.
"Swear it! Swear it! This is no game of jacks or tag or Johnny Jump My Pony. Thee's not a child any longer. Swear to me. Swear that thee are still pure."
"No," Susan said, and turned to leave. Her heart was beating madly, but still that awful clarity informed the world. Roland would have known it for what it was. She was seeing with gunslinger's eyes. There was a glass window in the kitchen looking out toward the drop, and in it she saw the ghostly reflection of Aunt Cord coming toward her, one arm raised, the hand at the end of it knotted into a fist. Without turning, Susan put up her own hand in a halting gesture.
"Raise that knot to me," she said. "Raise it not, ye bitch!"
She saw the reflection's ghost eyes widen in shock and dismay. She saw the ghost fist relax, become a hand again, fall to the ghost woman's side.
"Susan," Cordelia said in a small, hurt voice, "how can ye call me so? What's so coarsened your tongue and your regard for me?"
Susan went out without replying. She crossed the yard and entered the barn. Here the smells she had known since childhood, horses, lumber, hay, filled her head and drove the awful clarity away. She was tumbled back into childhood, lost in the shadows of her confusion again. Pylon turned to look at her and whickered. Susan put her head against his neck and cried. 7.
"There," Sheriff Avery said when Size Dearborn and Heath were gone. "It's as you said. Just slow is all they are, just creepin' careful."
He held the meticulously printed list up, studied it a moment, then cackled happily.
"And look at this. What a beauty. Ha! We can move anything we don't want 'em to see days in advance, so we can."
"They're fools," Reynolds said. But he pined for another chance at them just the same. If Dearborn really thought bygones were bygones over that little business in the Traveler's Rest, he was way past foolishness and dwelling in the land of idiocy. Deputy Dave said nothing. He was looking disconsolately through his monocle at the castle's board, where his white army had been laid waste in 6 quick moves. Jonas's forces had poured around Red Hillock like water, and Dave's hopes had been swept away in the flood.
"I'm tempted to wrap myself up dry and go over to seafront with this," Avery said.
He was still gloating over the paper with its neat list of farms and ranches and proposed dates of inspection, up to year's end and beyond, it ran. Gods!
"Why don't you do that?" Jonas said and got to his feet.
Pain ran up his leg like bitter lightning.
"Another game, Si Jonas?" Dave asked, beginning to reset the pieces.
"I'd rather play a weed-eaten dog," Jonas said, and took malicious pleasure at the flush that crept up Dave's neck and stained his guileless fool's face.
He limped across to the door, opened it, and went out on the porch. The drizzle had become a soft, steady rain. Hill Street was deserted, the cobbles gleaming wetly. Reynolds had followed him out.
"Eldred, get away,"
Jonas said without turning. Clay hesitated a moment, then went back inside and closed the door.
"What the hell's wrong with you?" Jonas asked himself.
He should have been pleased at the two young pups and their list, as pleased as Avery was, as pleased as Reimer would be when he heard about this morning's visit. After all, hadn't he told Reimer not 3 days ago that the boys would soon be over on the drop, counting their little hearts out? Yes. So why did he feel so unsettled, so fucking jittery? Because there still hadn't been any contact from Farson's men, Latigo? Because Reynolds came back empty from Hanging Rock on one day and DePape came back empty the next? Surely not. Latigo would come, along with a goodly troop of men, but it was still too soon for them, and Jonas knew it. Reaping was still almost a month away.
So? Is it just the bad weather, working on your leg, stirring up that old wound and making you ugly?
No. The pain was bad, but it had been worse before. The trouble was his head. Jonas leaned against a post beneath the overhang, listened to the rain plinking on the tiles, and thought how sometimes in a game of castles a clever player would peek around his hillock for just a moment, then duck back. That was what this felt like. It was so right, it smelled wrong. Crazy idea. But somehow not crazy at all.
"Are you trying to play castles with me, Sprat?" Jonas murmured. "If so, you'll soon wish you'd stayed home with your mommy. So you will."
8. Roland and Cuthbert headed back to the barquet along the drop. There would be no counting done today. At first, in spite of the rain and the gray skies, Cuthbert's good humor was almost entirely restored.
"Did you see them?" he asked with a laugh. "Did you see them, Roland? Will, I mean? They bought it, didn't they? Swallowed that honey whole, they did."
"Yes."
"What do we do next? What's our next move?"
Roland looked at him blankly for a moment, as if startled out of a doze. "The next move is theirs. We count, and we wait." Cuthbert's good cheer collapsed in a puff, and he once more found himself having to restrain a flood of recrimination, all whirling around two basic ideas: that Roland was shirking his duty so he could continue to wallow in the undeniable charms of a certain young lady, and, more important, that Roland had lost his wits when all of Midworld needed them the most. Except, what duty was Roland shirking? And what made him so sure Roland was wrong? Logic? Intuition? Or just shitty old catbox jealousy? Cuthbert found himself thinking of the effortless way Jonas had ripped up Deputy Dave's army when Deputy Dave had moved too soon. But life was not like castles, was it? He didn't know. But he thought he had at least one valid intuition. Roland was heading for disaster. And so they all were.
"Wake up," Cuthbert thought. "Please, Roland, wake up before it's too late."
3. Playing Castles. 1. There followed a week of the sort of weather that makes folks apt to crawl back into bed after lunch, take long naps, and wake feeling stupid and disoriented. It was far from flood weather, But it made the final phase of the apple-picking dangerous. There were several broken legs, and in Seven Mile Orchard a young woman fell from the top of her ladder, breaking her back. And the potato fields became difficult to work. Almost as much time was spent freeing wagons stuck in the gluey rows as was spent actually picking. In Greenheart, what decorations had been done for the reaping fair grew sodden and had to be pulled down. The work volunteers waited with increasing nervousness for the weather to break so they could begin again. It was bad weather for young men whose job it was to take inventory, although they were at least able to begin visiting barns and counting stock. It was good weather for a young man and young woman who had discovered the joys of physical love, you would have said, but Roland and Susan met only twice during the run of gray weather. The danger of what they were doing was now almost palpable. The first time was in an abandoned boathouse on the Seacoast Road. The second was in the far end of the crumbling building below and to the east of Sitco. They made love with furious intensity on one of Roland's saddle blankets, which was spread on the floor of what had once been the oil refinery's cafeteria. As Susan climaxed, she shrieked his name over and over. Startled pigeons filled the old shadowy rooms and crumbling hallways with their soft thunder. 2. Just as it seemed that the drizzle would never end and the grinding sound of the thinny in the still air would drive everyone in Hambury insane, a strong wind, almost a gale, blew in off the ocean and puffed the clouds away. The town awoke one day to a sky as bright as blue steel and a sun that turned the bay to gold in the morning and white fire in the afternoon. That sense of lethargy was gone. In the potato fields the carts rolled with new vigor. In Greenheart an army of women began once more to bedeck with flowers the podium where Jamie McCann and Susan Delgado would be acclaimed this year's reaping lad and girl. Out on the part of the drop closest to Mayor's house, Roland, Cuthbert, and Alan rode with renewed purpose, counting the horses which ran with the barony brand on their flanks. The bright skies and brisk winds filled them with energy and good cheer, and for a course of days, three or perhaps four, they galloped together in a whooping, shouting, laughing line, their old good fellowship restored. On one of these brisk and sunny days, Eldred Jonas stepped out of the sheriff's office and walked up Hill Street toward Greenheart. He was free of both DePape and Reynolds this morning. They had ridden out to Hanging Rock together, looking for Letigo's outriders, who must come soon now. And Jonas's plan was simple, to have a glass of beer in the pavilion and watch the preparations that were going on there. The digging of the roasting pits, the laying of faggots for the bonfire, the arguments over how to set the mortars that would shoot off the fireworks, the ladies flowering the stage where this year's lad and girl would be offered for the town's adulation. Perhaps, Jonas thought, he might take a likely-looking flower girl off for an hour or two of recreation. The maintenance of the saloon whores he left strictly to Roy and Clay. But a fresh young flower girl of 17 or so was a different matter. The pain in his hip had faded with the damp weather. The painful, lurching stride with which he had moved for the last week or so had become a mere limp again. Perhaps just a beer or two in the open air would be enough. But the thought of a girl wouldn't quite leave his head. Young, clear-skinned, high-breasted, fresh, sweet breath, fresh, sweet lips. Mr. Jonas? Eldred? He turned, smiling, to the owner of the voice. No dewy-complexioned flower girl with wide eyes and moist, parted lips stood there, but a skinny woman edging into late middle age, flat chest, flat bum, tight pale lips, hair scrooped so tight against her skull that it fair screamed. Only the wide eyes corresponded with his daydream. "I believe I've made a conquest," Jonas thought sardonically. "Why, Cordelia," he said, reaching out and taking one of her hands in both of his. "How lovely you look this morning." Thin color came up in her cheeks, and she laughed a little.
For a moment she looked 45 instead of 60. And she's not 60, Jonas thought. The lines around her mouth and the shadows under her eyes, those are new.
You're very kind, she said, but I know better. I haven't been sleeping, and when women my age don't sleep, they grow old rapidly.
I'm sorry to hear you're sleeping badly, he said. But now that the weather's changed, perhaps...
It's not the weather. Might I speak to you, Eldred? I've thought and thought, and you're the only one I dare turn to for advice.
His smile widened. He placed her hand through his arm, then covered it with his own. Now her blush was like fire. With all that blood in her head, she might talk for hours. And Jonas had an idea that every word would be interesting. Three. With women of a certain age and temperament, tea was more effective than wine when it came to loosening the tongue. Jonas gave up his plans for a lager and perhaps a flower girl without so much as a second thought. He seated Cy Delgado in a sunny corner of the Greenheart Pavilion, it was not far from a red rock Roland and Susan knew well, and ordered a large pot of tea, cakes too. They watched the reaping fair preparations go forward as they waited for the food and drink. The sun-swept park was full of hammering and sawing and shouts and bursts of laughter.
All fair days are pleasant, but reaping turns us all into children again, don't you find?
Cordelia asked.
Yes, indeed,
said Jonas, who hadn't felt like a child even when he had been one.
What I still like best is the bonfire, she said,
looking toward the great pile of sticks and boards that was being constructed at the far end of the park, catter-corner from the stage. It looked like a large wooden teepee.
I love it when the townsfolk bring their stuffy guys and throw them on. Barbaric, but it always gives me such a pleasant shiver.
Aye, Jonas said, and wondered if it would give her a pleasant shiver to know that three of the stuffy guys thrown onto the Reap Night bonfire this year were apt to smell like pork and scream like harpies as they burned. If his luck was in, the one that screamed the longest would be the one with the pale blue eyes. The tea and cakes came, and Jonas didn't so much as glance at the girl's full bosom when she bent to serve. He had eyes only for the fascinating Cy Delgado, with her nervous little shifting movements and odd, desperate look. When the girl was gone, he poured out, put the teapot back on its trivet, then covered her hand with his.
"Now, Cordelia," he said in his warmest tone. I can see something troubles you. Out with it. Confide in your friend Eldred.
Her lips pressed so tightly together that they almost disappeared, but not even that effort could stop their trembling. Her eyes filled with tears, swam with them, overspilled. He took his napkin and, leaning across the table, wiped the tears away.
Tell me, he said tenderly.
I will. I must tell somebody or go mad. But you must make one promise, Eldred.
Of course, Molly.
He saw her blush more furiously than ever at this harmless endearment and squeezed her hand.
Anything.
You mustn't tell Hart, that disgusting spider of a chancellor either, but especially not the mayor. If I'm right in what I suspect, and he found out, he could send her west.
She almost moaned this, as if comprehending it as a real fact for the first time.
He could send us both west.
Maintaining his sympathetic smile, he said,
Not a word to Mayor Thorin, not a word to Kimber Rymer. Promise.
For a moment he thought that she wouldn't take the plunge, or perhaps couldn't. Then, in a low, gaspy voice that sounded like ripping cloth, she said a single word.
Dearborn!
He felt his heart take a bump as the name that had been so much in his mind now passed her lips, and although he continued to smile, he could not forbear a single hard squeeze of her fingers that made her wince.
I'm sorry, he said. It's just that you startled me a little. Dearborn,
a well-spoken enough lad, but I wonder if he's entirely trustworthy.
I fear he's been with my Susan.
Now it was her turn to squeeze, but Jonas didn't mind. He hardly felt it, in fact. He continued to smile, hoping he did not look as flabbergasted as he felt.
I fear he's been with her, as a man is with a woman. Oh, how horrible this is!
She wept with a silent bitterness, taking little pecking peeks around as she did to make sure they were not being observed. Jonas had seen coyotes and wild dogs look around from their stinking dinners in just that fashion. He let her get as much of it out of her system as he could. He wanted her calm. Incoherencies wouldn't help him. And when he saw her tears slackening, he held out a cup of tea.
"Drink this."
"Yes, thank you."
The tea was still hot enough to steam, but she drank it down greedily.
Her old throat must be lined with slate, Jonas thought.
She set the cup down, and while he poured out fresh, she used her frilly pañuelo to scrub the tears almost viciously from her face.
"I don't like him," she said. "Don't like him, don't trust him. None of those three with their fancy in-world bows and insolent eyes and strange ways of talking, but him in particular. Yet if anything's gone on betwixt the two of them, and I'm so afraid it has, it comes back to her, doesn't it? It's the woman, after all, who must refuse the bestial impulses."
He leaned over the table, looking at her with warm sympathy.
"Tell me everything, Cordelia."
She did.